thank you very much, Professor Parry, for a very kind and generous introduction. And I'd like to thank you and your colleagues at the LSE for inviting me to give the Malinowski Lecture in 2002. And I'd particularly like to thank Barbara Wesley, who's made great efforts on my behalf to get me here in one piece. And I'd also like to thank friends and colleagues for coming, some who have come from afar. Now, technology. I'm just going to click on this and hope something happens. Right. Okay. Now you shouldn't have had all that all at one point. Where is Ed? It's okay? Okay. Sorry about this. This was bound to happen. Any advance on Ed? Who set this up for me? No, not quite. Click which? One. Oh no, not cut. Where's Ed? File. You see, I'm used to an Apple, and Apple do things for you. PCs, you have to do things with them. That's it.
Yeah.
That's fun. Well, this is my fun. Right. Thank you very much. My apologies. Okay. Is the sound okay? In this lecture, I would like to return to a town of 15,000 people in the north of England, in which I first worked in 1987, then again in 1990, and more recently between 2000 and 2001. My last fieldwork was funded by the Wellcome Trust, to which I extend my thanks. My aim was to look again, 10 years later, at people's understanding of latest technologies of assisted conception. As well as honoured to be giving the Malinowski Memorial Lecture in 2002, it pleases me to be able to present you with words and ideas from Baker, partly because it and the London School of Economics share, as they say, a history. At the very least, they share a relative. If you'll allow me to digress before I even begin. By all accounts, LSE was the brainchild of Sydney and Beatrice Webb, conceived in 1894 with the legacy of Mr. Hutchinson, who, before committing suicide, appointed Sydney Webb as an executor and stipulated that a large part of the money that he left was to promote the Fabian Society and its socialism, to be used to promote the Fabian Society and its socialism. My recent reading of Beatrice Webb's diaries for this lecture suggests a woman with influence. This is an example from, this quote I find interesting from the editors of her diaries. While Beatrice was born and bred a member of the governing class, Sydney was born and bred in the lower middle class, by training and temperament a civil servant, and happy to defer to Beatrice in all the policies of the partnership. When she diverted him from parliamentary to municipal politics, enlisted him in the trade union history she already proposed to write, she deprived the Liberals of a talented politician and provided herself with an untiring, loyal, and immensely able instrument of her will. Now, I used the word brainchild advisedly. In the words of Beatrice, LSE was, I quote, at first a sickly infant of doubtful parentage, born into an indifferent, if not hostile, world. Official biographer Royd and Harris notes that apart from the LSE, the Webbs showed no enduring parental feeling for any other of their offspring. They had no children. A decision and a fact that Beatrice returns to again and again in her diaries. Beatrice's mother, Laurencina Hayworth, was born in Baker, the daughter of a prosperous mill owner. She married Richard Potter and moved to the Cotswolds, taking her personal maid, Martha Jackson, with her. Beatrice was the eighth daughter of Lawrence and Richard's nine daughters. And Martha, it turns out, was a poor and distant relative from Baker. Beatrice decided in 1883 to visit Baker. She went in disguise, pretending to be Miss Jones, a Welsh farmer's daughter, and used Martha as her cover. Now, Beatrice was clearly a bit of a curiosity, smoking with the men and talking about conditions of labour. She also writes of the impact Baker had upon her and the welcome and hospitality with which she was received. She writes of the decency and social well-being compared to the East End of London, where she'd been working under the umbrella of the Charity Organisation Committee. For her, the marriage of religion and cooperation she witnessed in Baker made for what she thought was a spiritually healthy and morally wealthy population. What she thought to be the success of her trip incognito led her to promote the use of disguise in social investigation. Observation is, in fact, vitiated, she wrote, if the person observed know that they are being observed. And she visited Baker upon two more occasions, in 1886 and 1889. So that's when she went. That was about the age she was when she went to Baker. Now, these last week I went to the Baker Natural History Society, which is now a local history society, and I asked them, could they find me any photographs from around this period? And they were delighted, because now there was evidence that by now I had come to my senses and I was going to do a proper study of history and no more of this kind of ordinary day-to-day business. And the new archivist of the photographs, he's now into computers and a scanner, and he found this from an old postcard, and he said this is around 1886, and you know, because the tram lines aren't in and the factory chimneys are there. And as I was leaving, he said, I told him what this was for, and he said, shall I put a little coach and horse in the front for you? So that was really lovely. Okay. She visited in 1886 and 1889, and on the second occasion revealed her identity, which seemed to have provoked little in the way of interest. Baker became the baseline from which she measured other working-class communities. For her, it was the altar to sweatshops of East London. According to one of her biographers, the spirit of collectivism and cooperation she found in Baker broke the final thread attaching her to Herbert Spencer's philosophy of individualism and her family's adherence to laissez-faire capitalism. According to another, Baker provided Beatrice with the antidote to what she understood as her own middle-class, fragmented, ungrounded, and rootless upbringing. The point to make is that Beatrice herself cites Baker as the catalyst which propelled her on the road of social investigation and led her to socialism. Now, there's an unreflexive romanticism in Beatrice Webb's musings about Baker, and they never really get beyond the idea of a homogeneous working class. And I feel sure that members of the Baker Natural History Society would urge her to look at the pubs as well as the chapels and the feckless as well as the respectable. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, historians of LSE have little to say about Beatrice. But my sense is that she was influential in setting the agenda and in the decisions, persuasion and politicking it took to launch and nurture the LSE through its first years of infancy. Now, so here we have around 1886, 1890. Right, here we have 1990. And here we have 2000. My last field work in Baker was partly inspired by a constant refrain in the media and from academic and professional colleagues that the public used to be anxious about new reproductive technologies, or NRT, things like in vitro fertilization, IVF, and the donation of gametes, ova, and sperm. But they've sort of got used to them. This is the argument that's put forward. And it will be the same with technologies such as cloning and stem cell therapy. This lecture is partly about the way in which a decade does and doesn't make a difference. Returning to a fieldwork site and asking similar questions to those you asked 10 years ago is a salutary, discomforting, and intriguing experience. When I returned in 2000, I could no longer rely on naivety. After all, the getting to know had been done. I could not plead ignorance of the immediate social world in which I wished to understand. And any attempt to ask the kind of questions that I got away with 10 years ago would have been revealed as artifice and given short shrift by those who now knew me better. Initially, I was teased a great deal. I was warned that I would have to drop my airs and graces I may have picked up deliberately or inadvertently in the intervening years as a university lecturer. At the NAT, witty asides had the effect of connecting me to the past and to the old guard who claimed familiarity and thus brought into relief a distinction between themselves and the new guard who were, they said, taking over. The treasurer declared often and loudly that I hadn't paid my subs for 10 years. Many of the women with whom I'd played darts Many of the women with whom I'd played darts 13 years ago were still playing in the Baker Ladies Darts team. And although the teams and membership in the league had reconfigured, stories of fission and fusion, fallout and reconciliation were animated in response to my questions of what happened to so-and-so. At the beginning of the 2000 season, Nina Grimshaw and I joined the B team of Rosemount Catholic Club. She vouched for me, not as a good dart player, but all right, as a person. At the end of the season, Rosemount B were runners-up in the Dominoes Championship, and my fellow team members thought it amusing that I should request a trophy rather than a gift voucher. While this last fieldwork in Baker is ostensibly aimed to investigate understandings of new reproductive and genetic technologies, I had to be re-socialized and brought up to date. I was told of family and other intimate relationships forged and broken over the last decade, the growing of children into recalcitrant adolescents and beyond, for the most part, according to their parents, into lovely kids. Some of them now had children of their own, some of whom I now interviewed in their homes. I was told of the continued decline of the town and latest attempts at its economic regeneration, which included government money from the single regeneration budget and initiatives such as Sure Start, as well as several failed lottery bids. I observed consortium meetings set up to decide how to spend the money wisely and chatted to volunteers in the office of the Tenants Association. I was told about the yes vote to keep council houses under local authority control, even though it was common knowledge has it that they're still renting to the wrong people. I was told about the revamping of the market hotel into a tapas bar, which wasn't doing too well, and the trendy new and expensive hairstylists, which was doing much better. I ate tapas and had my hair cut. A decade makes a difference. For the most part, however, Baker appears untouched by the economic regeneration of English cities. There are concerns about the amount of heroin use in the town. And the view about the town being left out and ignored are as prevalent today as they were 10 years ago. And there's little in the way in the sign of jobs or the turnaround that was promised. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons for my return to Bake Up in 2000 was to determine whether a decade had made a difference to people's understandings of NRT. And I am, for the purposes of this lecture, going to focus on the way in which incest emerged, as it did in 1990, in response to questions about the substitution of gametes, as in sperm and overdonation, and wombs, as in surrogacy arrangements. And I argue that the concept of incest acts as a conceptual break, a limit to possibilities presented by biotechnological intervention in conception, but that it is not a fixed and predictable quality and goes beyond an understanding of biogenetic connection, even while embracing it. This next section I've called Suvasova and Superadded. You'll see why. Anthropological discussion of incest through the last century revolved around explanations for what was assumed to be its universal avoidance. Indeed, Levi-Strauss, like Freud, built incest into a theory of the emergence of culture. For him, the prohibition of incest and its flip side, exogamy, differentiated human and non-human animals and allowed cultures to transcend nature. This is familiar. Human beings were thought to be either naturally inclined or naturally disinclined to desire sexual relations with close kin. Westermarck famously argued, unsuccessfully at the time, that familiarity blunted the edge of sexual attraction and that close physical proximity from early childhood inhibited sexual desire. Malinowski disagreed. In 1927, he wrote, I quote, "Under the mechanisms which constitute the human family, various temptations to incest arise. For him, it was seriously, quote, incompatible with the first foundations of culture." Malinowski was at pains at the time to emphasize that biologists were in agreement that incestuous unions produce no detrimental effects to the species. Therefore, any explanation for its avoidance, he argued, must lie in the social rather than the biological order of things. For Malinowski, incest posed a threat to the stability of family life by subverting the regular and ordered relations between kin. The Trobriand Islanders, whom Malinowski consulted, reserved the term suvasova, which he translated as clan incest or breach of exogamy, for sexual relations between members of the same subclan, the most heavily sanctioned of which were between brother and sister. Suvasova, even if undiscovered or unknown, revealed itself in a disease visible on the skin of the guilty. At the time, the needs of the family and household were, in Malinowski's words, superadded to the incest taboo. And thus sexual relations between, for example, a father and daughter, if not suvasova, were nevertheless reprehensible. Malinowski's insistence on incest as disruptive of the ordered and stable family relationships needed in the socialization of children was clearly influential in his recommendation to the Church of England in 1940 that they lift the prohibition of marriage with in-laws. Now, if incest refers to sexual intercourse between close kin, social anthropologists know, are well aware, that what constitutes closeness cannot be assumed. Sybil Wolfram traces historically the way in which the list of kin between whom sexual intercourse is considered incestuous in English law has progressively diminished. And the list again is different in Scotland. Louisa Campos, a Piro woman of the Bajo Urubamba, hinted darkly to Peter Gow of the depravity of a man who wished to marry his wife's daughter by a previous marriage. Janet Carston describes the concern of Lankawi women, of Lankawi mothers, that infants suckled at the same breast, however casually and informally, may, in the future, not knowing they are related, marry. In a significant analysis of child sexual abuse in the UK, Jean LaFontaine reminds us that incest is not only about consenting marrying adults, and that incest and marriage prohibition are not coterminous. The fact that sexual relations may be permitted between people for whom marriage is prohibited has required anthropologists to theoretically unhitch sex from marriage. We need to do the same for sex and reproduction. New reproductive technologies provide a way, both physically and abstractly, of unhitching reproduction from sexual intercourse. My interest in incest is in the way in which it emerges when neither sexual intercourse nor marriage are at issue. In the context of NRT, a concept of incest sometimes is evoked, bereft of sex and replete with reproduction. Now, with reference to NRT, the concept emerges in a number of contexts. Let me outline four before looking at specific examples. One, sometimes NRT provokes a general and generalized disquiet, which is not necessarily pinpointed, but given expression through the notion of incest. It's all a bit incestuous, has been a common response to possibilities presented by the biotechnological assistance of conception. The messing about, as it is called, of gametes and embryos and the movement of them around different bodies evokes a general notion. Two, a scenario evoked as often in the year 2000 as it was in 1990 is of children born of gametes donated from the same person who meet up and, not knowing they are related, fall in love, marry, and reproduce. Now, I want to argue that it is reproduction at stake here. LaFontaine notes for the UK that, unlike child sexual abuse, the idea of incest arouses no strong emotion. I should want to add, except that is when reproduction is at stake. Three, it is a mistake, however, to think of incest only in terms of the commingling of reproductive materials, i.e. gametes. It is a function of closeness, and as I noted earlier, closeness is envisaged in many ways. In the English kinship thinking with which I'm concerned here, children gestated in the same womb are too close, regardless of their genetic connection. And I'm struck by the examples that I was given of how incest could stem from surrogacy arrangements. So the children born of the same surrogate mother may in the future meet up, not knowing they're related, have a child together. Four, incest emerges as a break to certain procedures which might be thought of as self-evidently incestuous, the substitution of gametes between kin, for example, between whom sexual relations would be considered incestuous. Now, in what follows, I shall present extracts from transcripts of recorded interviews in order to convey a sense of the way in which connections are made. And I shall embed the dialogue in some detail in an attempt to put some ethnographic flesh onto the bare bones of narrative. The Royal Court Theatre was opened in Bacup in 1893, 10 years after Beatrice Webb's first visit to the town, and was advertised at the time as one of the handsomest and best-equipped theatres in Lancashire. It has had a checkered history, a venue for silent movies, home to the Bacup Amateur Dramatic Society, and staged to performances of all kinds by visiting theatre companies and famous and not-so-famous artists. It's a financial struggle to keep it going and requires effort from loyal volunteers, a hard-working local management committee, and enthusiastic amateur actors, musicians, stagehands, and producers. Noreen and Carl Poole are linchpins in the theatre and have been involved with it in one way or the other for over 30 years. They're now retired and spend a good part of most days at the theatre, manning the box office, showing people around, dealing with publicity, taking care of committee business, and so on. Carl, particularly, is proud of the theatre and thinks it's a gem worth preserving. In his opinion, however, they've never received enough support from the local authority. This theatre, he says, if it was in Rawtenstall, would have been done up now, and it would be a lovely civic theatre. But because it's in Baker, it's at the other end of the valley, it's ignored. Noreen is not convinced. I don't know, she says. I think the only way it is keeping open is because we've got it. If it was the council's, they couldn't afford to keep it. They'd run it down. Now, I talked with them in the foyer of the theatre one afternoon, and our conversation was punctuated by Carl dealing with requests by telephone and in person for tickets for the pantomime. And this year it was Jack and the Beanstalk. At the time, the British media were reporting the dispute between Mr. and Mrs. Kilshaw and social services about the status of the babies they'd adopted from the United States. Noreen tells me, that was awful buying them over the internet. I don't agree with that. The children aren't, they treat them like dolls when they start doing things like that. I think the egg is the better way. A better way of doing it if you want a child. At least it seems it's inside you and it's coming out of you, even if it's been planted. You're still the mother of it. Now, it's not clear in what Noreen says subsequently whether the egg she's referring to is a donated ovum or an embryo implanted after IVF. But the point she makes serves to emphasise the significance of the connection created between a mother and child in the body of the woman. Let me pursue this notion of corporeality a little further. One young Bake-Up woman told me that she thinks her sister, with whom she shares her mother, is more her sister than her brother, with whom she shares her father. She calls one her sister and one her half-brother, even though, she explains, they are both halves. Her friend is listening to this and sees me struggling to make notes. She explains slowly, you only say half if you have different dads, because if you've got the same mum, you're proper. I ask her why she thinks that is. Your mums give birth to you all, but your dad is different. And her friend adds in a stage whisper, just a sperm donation, really. Now, the point I want to underline so far is that in English kinship thinking, the biogenetic connection is gendered and links come in different strengths. Also, biogenetic connection mediated by gametes is augmented in the bodies of women. If this is the case, it may shed light on why incest is not considered as an absolute and fixed entity, and why some forms are more reprehensible than others. A group of young mums, their term. Meet weekly at a local youth and community centre. The group was founded by Lindsay, who, with the backing of the Youth and Community Service, set it up as a support group for teenage mothers like herself. The women range from 16 to 20 years old, and their infants from 3 months to 3 years. At the time I met them, a rather tetchy discussion had begun between workers and the young women about whether there should be an age limit set on membership. The message from the youth and community workers was that the women should leave the group when they left their teenage years. Two women who were now in their 20s were forcefully arguing against such a rule, and Lindsay was adamant that as a founder member, she would stay as long as she saw fit. Transport is provided to and from the centre for the women and their infants, and a creche worker looks after the children while the women take classes in things like computing, nutrition, and beauty therapy. They also organise posses to IKEA and to a garden centre, a well-known garden centre nearby, mostly to browse and to pick up ideas. And at the time I met them, they were arranging to visit Camelot, the theme park. The women are mostly on small and fixed incomes, and a regular topic of conversation revolves around comparing and sharing information on bargains in terms of shopping for food and baby clothes. They fitted me into a busy schedule, and I met up with them on three consecutive Wednesday afternoons. And I started our second meeting by asking them whether they thought sperm donors should be anonymous. Georgina, well, I was against knowing them. But then again, if they ever met someone and then they found out they were brothers or something, you know, it's interbred, basically. Lindsay, yeah, because that bloke could donate. He could go in a room and donate two lots of sperm. However that is, I don't know. But he could do it. And then whoever gets them two lots of sperm, those kids could meet each other, and then if they had a baby together, the baby would be disabled. Does that make sense? Georgina, it does to me. Lindsay, so you'd need to know who to stay away from so that you don't have disabled children. Georgina points to the danger of interbreeding. Lindsay explores how it might happen. Children conceived of sperm from the same donor meet up and, not knowing they are related, have a baby together. The child of their union will be, in Lindsay's terms, disabled. Georgina and Lindsay's misgivings here should not be read, however, as an endorsement for the substitution of gametes between known persons. I asked them later in our conversation, What about people? Some people say it should be kept in the family. You know, like you should get your eggs from sisters or aunties or mothers. Georgie, no, I wouldn't like to do that. Maya, I couldn't do it with my sister because she'd always look at your child and they would have some kind of... Georgina, it's like when you're disciplining them. And if I saw them whacking the child or something, I'd be like, no, get off. Lindsay, even though you haven't given birth to that child, it's been your eggs, and it's born from your eggs, isn't it? Alice, I know, but you just have to tell yourself, wouldn't you, that it's not mine, it's not mine, it's not mine. Maya, but it mightn't be as easy as that. The young women identify a disruption to family roles caused by the conflation of mother and aunt. A person is a mother if she provides an ovum and an aunt if she is the mother's sister. What happens if she's both? If you were to donate an egg to your sister, these women point out, you might have a stake in the ensuing child that would compel you to interfere in its upbringing. Around the time of this conversation, there was a newspaper reported that men were asking their fathers to provide semen rather than using anonymous sperm. I asked the women about such a procedure. It provoked a heartfelt yuck. Lindsay asks us to imagine using your boyfriend's dad's sperm. It would feel like you had sex with your boyfriend's father. The baby, she says, would be like your boyfriend's brother. Actually, she reflects, not even sperm from your boyfriend's friend would be okay. It would feel like you cheated on him. What would you say? I'm having my boyfriend's father's or boyfriend's friend's baby? She continues, what if they butted in later? Wanted to have a say in how the child was brought up. My boyfriend's father is very narrow-minded. Now, Lindsay is not only concerned with the conflict of roles, but also contested ideas of how to bring up a child and the values that should be promoted and passed on. English ideas about what constitutes a parent revolve around the responsibility for the adequate care and well-being on a daily basis of children on a daily basis. Questioning a person's ability as a parent is taken as harsh criticism. To be told how to bring up one's child, or to be told that you are, as a parent, doing a bad job, is not taken lightly. It cuts deep into one's identity as a proper person. Returning to our conversation, Lindsay asks Maya, could you have Simon's dad's sperm inside you? The response is again a resounding yuck. But why is it so bad, I ask, even while understanding that it must be. Lindsay looks at me sideways and decides to reassure me. Oh, it's just a spare me thing. And Maya explains slowly, eggs are nice and sperm's not nice at the best of times. Sperm acts as a mediator, a link that connects a woman, in this example, to her boyfriend's father. The connection created in this way bypasses her boyfriend. It creates the potential for a conflict of roles when a father's father may assume the demeanour of a father rather than a grandfather. May and Lindsay are also objecting to the corporeality and incorporation of a substance which not only connects them to their boyfriend's father, but also evokes the stickiness of Sartre's essay that Mary Douglas impressed on us many years ago in her thesis on boundary crossing. The viscous, Sartre wrote, is halfway between solid and liquid, soft, yielding, and compressible. Stickiness is clinging, drips in columns off the finger. An aberrant fluid, or melting solid, Douglas adds. Now, there's been much made of the yuck factor, particularly in media discussion of certain procedures in NRT. The argument was put forward by expert commentators that responses from the public, such as yuck, were irrational and should not be allowed to lead or influence policy. In Baker, yuck would be defined as a gut feeling, and gut feelings are valuable. They're not something to be lightly dismissed. As one woman put it, this is her words, it's emotional feelings that affect your logical decision, whether you like it or not. Why do they assume that a gut feeling isn't intelligent? Your brain tells you now that's a gut feeling, that this isn't quite safe, that it isn't right, and you revert to that fight and flight. But the original feeling is a gut feeling. So it's like instinct, isn't it, these gut feelings? I think they're instincts. I think they're a safety mechanism. And she gives me an example. Do you never meet somebody and think there's something not right about this? It's like preservation, isn't it? Well, I won't mix with this person, there's something not right. But they are gut feelings. They're not logically worked out feelings, she said. And another woman located it more in the chest than the gut. It's to know something in the chest, not the head. She told me, impressing on me the fact the feelings matter. Just as belonging is perceived to be an emotional attachment, and infants are known to require emotional attachments in order to grow into proper persons with emotions. From this, there is nothing awry from this perspective in an emotional response to a technoscientific procedure in reproduction. I first met Moira Heaney in 1987 when she was captain of the darts team with which I played occasionally. She was single, worked in a local shoe factory, claimed to be uninterested in marriage and children. I met her again last year at a Wednesday evening darts match. She now lives with her partner and her 13-year-old daughter and is working as a care assistant for a local company contracted by social services to provide home help. She explains to me that everybody's out of shoes now, and they're all into care work because that's all there is. She thinks Bake Up has changed a lot since we last met, and nothing comes into this town now. Half the shops and half the factories have closed down in those years. I explained why I was back in Bake Up and told her some of what I'd been doing over the past few years. She said she wouldn't mind being interviewed. Moira wanted to talk about cloning, which she thought was going too far. And although she said she knew it was meant to be about growing extra body parts and bones, she didn't think it was natural, not like IVF, which she said was fair enough because it's done a natural way. When I asked her what she meant, she explained that the embryo is put back into the body, into the body to grow, and is born naturally, and it's just a boost to help the couple on their way. Now, her comments highlight the way in which a decade does and doesn't make a difference, and it could be read to confirm the view I outlined earlier, that people become accustomed to new technologies, and the novel, in this case cloning, eclipses the familiar, in this case IVF. And of interest is the way in which Moira legitimates IVF. It is natural insofar as ovum and sperm are used, and the fetus is gestated in a womb, and parturition occurs naturally. IVF helps a couple fulfill their desire by giving nature a boost. Cloning for Moira is going too far. It doesn't require the usual reproductive materials and evokes the image of embryos in laboratories, grown for tissues and bones without the outcome of pregnancy and birth. For Moira, the substitution of gametes lies somewhere between the two. She thinks care needs to be taken. For example, the sperm donor should not know the outcome of his donation, nor should the potential father know from whom the sperm came. Now, as in many conversations I've had in Bake Up about NRT, Moira draws on her own experience of intimate relations in exploring the possibilities presented by novel technologies. Later, she tells me that she's had no contact with her daughter's father since before her daughter's birth. He's shown no inclination thus far, she says, to make contact, and Moira now wants it to remain that way. In a way, she takes this experience into her assessment of the possibilities presented by the donation of gametes. For her, the thing to be cautious about is the unwanted and unsolicited attention of a sperm donor. He might, in her words, want to claim rights on the child. Reports of the death of nature might have been exaggerated. But while nature and the natural appear to be alive and well, they are, as Marilyn Strathern presciently alerted us 10 years ago, located differently in a conceptual scheme of things. If nature has not disappeared, she wrote, then its grounding function has. If one may choose to see a relationship either as socially constructed or as a natural state of affairs socially assisted, one is in fact choosing to consider what is natural. In IVF, according to Moira, the process of conception is technologically enhanced. The outcome, however, is pregnancy and childbirth. It is perceived to require the usual mixture of gametes and the gendered and fleshy body of a gestating mother. The gestation of a fetus in the womb of its mother renders IVF natural. In the light of what she identifies as the potential disruption to relationships that might be caused by known sperm donors, I ask Moira, is there an argument then for keeping it in the family? What about if a brother... No. Why is that? Well, it only needs them to fall out, doesn't it? And then it's, that's my child, not your child, really. And that will cause terrible problems. Well, what about what some people ask their fathers for sperm? Moira. Well, it's a bit weird, isn't it? In what way? Well, they'd be dad and granddad. I wouldn't like to think that my dad were the father of my child. It's like incest, that, anyway, isn't it? I couldn't go for that one. If I personally ever had to have it done myself, it'd have to be somebody anonymous. Moira reflects on why the substitution of a man's sperm with that of his father is weird. She points out that if she were to conceive a child using the sperm of her father, it would be like incest. I argue that it is thought to be incestuous, not only because of the mixing of reproductive materials that ought not to be mixed, but also because it is incorporated in the body of a daughter. Seven women, including myself, all of us between the ages of 40 and 60, are sitting around Laura Bright's kitchen table. A microphone balances on the top of an empty wine bottle, and the tape recorder vies for space with wine bottles and glasses, bowls of crisps and jars of dip, cigarettes and ashtrays, and I sit with a notebook in front of me and a pen in my hand. Five of the women have done something similar 10 years before, in this or another kitchen, or in a pub, club, or cafe. Two of the women I've only just met. They're neighbours of Laura, with whom I'm lodging. We've been talking about what children can see from donated gametes should be told. The conversation revolves around familiar themes of, on the one hand, the right of children to know where they came from, and on the other, what they don't know won't hurt them. Chris, the thing that would worry me more than this is the chances of a natural brother and sister meeting. You know, a lot of these laboratories producing sperm might not be ethical. Rose, well, it don't matter, does it really? Nina, if things get out of hand, they always say the records get lost. They don't get lost, they get shredded, don't they? Marion, you don't think it matters that brother and sister are? Rose, no, not really. Just for the one odd couple in the whole world at the end of the day. Marion, you don't think it would matter to that couple? Rose, but they wouldn't know, would they? Laura, if they didn't know, would it matter? Marion, well, I think if their children started coming out a little peculiar. Rose, but that can happen anyway, can't it? This is one of many examples of the way in which a mistrust of medical science and conviction that professionals will protect themselves at the expense of punters comes up over and over again. And Nina returns to this theme later. But here I want to draw attention to the way in which, for Chris, a shared genetic father makes for a natural brother and sister. And from this perspective, it is the innateness of their connection that makes their union problematic. And it will show, according to Marion, in their offspring. An incestuous union, in other words, will reveal itself in the next generation, whether it is known or unknown. Laura, Penny's dad made an interesting point about that. He said, well, we keep going on about things will go wrong if you inbreed. But he said in animals, they actually do this on purpose to get more positive characteristics. Marion, that's how come they've got such like Dalmatians that are deaf with inbreeding and they've got bulldogs that can't breathe. Rose, I tell you what though, there's more doing it and know that they're doing it than are accidentally going to do it. Marion, it might not matter to you, but I think it might matter to the couple that have married and that you realise you've married your brother. Laura, but how would they realise? Well, suppose they went for blood tests. Suppose they were having trouble conceiving. DNA testing, and they found out that they were brother and sister. Nina, it would be a shock. Marion, I think it would proper devastate any brother and sister if they found that out. Laura, if they ever found it out. Marion is keen throughout the conversation to return to the unfortunate brother and sister who find out later, after consummating their marriage, that they are related. She is incredulous at the suggestion from Rose that the occasional accidental union of brother and sister as husband and wife might not really matter. For Rose, it pales into insignificance compared to siblings who know they are related and have a sexual relationship. From this angle, incest is not in itself morally reprehensible, nor innately or essentially wrong. At issue is the deliberateness and the deliberation of it. What if nobody knew, including the protagonists, would it matter? I'm reminded of one young woman's observation about her father. When my dad were a baby, his father left and never came back. I said to him, don't you wish you knew what he looks like? And he said, no, I don't know any different. It's like a skeleton behind the door. You don't want to look and you don't want to know about it. For Marion, the skeleton will reveal itself whether you go looking or not. The unknown biogenetic connection runs the risk of becoming an incestuous liaison. And the outcome of incestuous unions are monstrous. I met Catherine Bates in the neighbourhood office, a centre run by council house tenants set up to facilitate a communication and improve relations between tenants and the local authority. Funded partly by the local authority, it was initiated in response to government calls for tenant representation in management committees. Like many initiatives that rely on voluntary labour, the centre's activities depend on the unpaid and substantial work of a number of retired, a small number of retired or unemployed people. When I first went to the centre, Mrs. Bates was concentrating on a newly installed computer, and with support on the telephone from a housing officer in Rawtenstall was setting up a mailing list. She had few words to spare. Over time, and after several visits to the centre, she agreed that I could visit her at home and record an interview with her. Mrs. Bates prefaced what she wanted to say about new reproductive technologies with her own reproductive history and experience. Her husband had died several years ago and her mother more recently, and she has one daughter and a teenage granddaughter. She told me she'd had five other pregnancies, all of which had resulted in either miscarriage or stillbirth. In her words, first one was in 1956, another one in 58, 60, 62, 63, then I had Sarah in 64 and the last one in 70. She told me about her last pregnancy. I was about 7 months pregnant and I asked could I see the baby, but they wouldn't let me. All I know, it was a boy. In fact, every one I've lost was a boy, and I can't equate that with anything at all. I mean, they always say that it's the father who sort of makes the gender of the child. You know, it's the father who determines what gender it is, but I don't know whether that's true or not. Then again, you always hear these stories that girls are stronger than boys anyway. You know, so perhaps if any of my other pregnancies had have been girls, I would have carried. I might have produced at least another one or two. Mrs. Bates was told the reason she had so many problems was that she had, she said, a tilted and twisted womb. But she clearly thinks it no coincidence that the one fetus which did survive was a girl. And she's heard that it is the father who makes the gender of the child. And if it was her husband who made boys and boys died. Perhaps this allows for responsibility to be shared. Now I ask her, given how difficult it was for her to carry a fetus to term, whether if she could have, she would have considered having a child with a surrogate mother. Catherine, I don't think I'd like that. I think I would have preferred to adopt rather than to have a surrogate child. Why wouldn't you like it? Catherine, well, because that child would be a half-brother or sister to somebody else, wouldn't they? In what way? Well, the surrogate mother provides the egg, the father produces the sperm. So if, just supposing now, we're speaking hypothetically, supposing you were willing to be a surrogate mother for me. You would produce the egg, my husband would donate the sperm, but there's nothing to stop you having other children by other people, you know, and they would all be interlinked. They would all be related through blood. What's to stop in future years, which I suppose could happen in any day and age, you've produced a girl, say, for one surrogate mother, and produced a boy for another, and then them two meet up 20 years on and marry. Where does that get you? You'd have a half-brother marrying a half-sister. Why does it matter? Well, it does, because hasn't it been proved in the past about interbreeding leading to all sorts of problems, ranging from insanity and things like that? That's my thoughts on it. The children born of the same surrogate who meet up and marry is of a piece with the children conceived of gametes from the same donor identified by Georgina and Chris earlier. Children born to parents who are themselves too closely related will incorporate the evidence. For Catherine, it may manifest itself in insanity, for Lindsay in disability, and for Marion in some kind of peculiarity. Wolfram, Sybil Wolfram's idiom is idiot children. She writes of how historically this idea predates biological explanation and is tenacious despite inconsistency in biological theory. Of course, in the 18th century, it was God rather than biology who intervened. Monsters, in the concise Oxford English Dictionary, are misshaped animals or deformed fetuses. Mrs. Bates goes on to think of surrogacy arrangements whereby the surrogate does not provide the ovum. She still thinks the baby would be part of the surrogate mother. I ask her what she means. Because it's got that surrogate mother's blood, the fetus feeds off the blood supply of the mother, of the person who is carrying the child. So that mother's blood is still going through the surrogate baby's veins. So it's never truly the parents. It's always part of the donor's blood scheme, isn't it? And they always say blood is thicker than water. Mrs. Bates gives a new swerve to the common English notion that blood is thicker than water. She identifies the way in which a surrogate mother, not genetically related to the fetus she carries, is inevitably and literally connected by the blood that flows between them. Just as Moira pushes forward the boundaries of the natural from conception to gestation, so Mrs. Bates configures the blood relative in the literalness of the blood shared between mother and fetus in the womb. For Mrs. Bates, the fetus may well be more firmly and persistently connected, belong, that is, to this mother, this blood mother, than to, more than to its genetic parents. Those belonging to the same surrogate, in this way, are related, and they also run the danger of an inadvertent and accidental incestuous relationship. Let me conclude. As I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, incest emerges as a break to certain procedures in NRT which might be thought of as self-evidently incestuous, such as the substitution of gametes between kin, between whom sexual relations would be considered incestuous. Clearly then, men cannot donate sperm to their sisters, nor can women donate over to their brothers. Donated gametes, however, are spoken of as if they went to and were received by women, where the fertilization takes place in vitro or in vivo. The embryo is grown in the body of the woman. From this perspective, a woman donating an ovum to her brother would in effect be giving it to an affine, to her sister-in-law. Whilst not quite right in terms of the mixing of reproductive materials, which ought to be kept separate, the growing of the fetus takes place in the body of the affine. While problematic and hardly condoned, it is not perceived to be as reprehensible as men donating sperm to their sisters. If incest were perceived only as the mixing of gametes that are too close, then it matters not in what body, petri dish or metaphorical test tube it takes place. But the point to make is that bodies matter, and incest is not merely a function of genetic closeness. If the outcome of incestuous unions are monstrous, such an outcome is as likely to stem from the closeness of cousins as siblings, or from that forged in the same womb or around the same kitchen table. Rather than questioning this in terms of the biological likelihood of this happening, of this outcome, or in terms of how far lay people's genetic knowledge lags behind their folk understanding, as social anthropologists, we ought to be in a position to address the question of why, in the face of evidence to the contrary, people persist in understanding the world in ways which order and regulate the day-to-day intimate relations of kinship in bodies that matter. Thank you.
Ideas about procreation are, in the end, probably just as interesting as those that Malinowski reported from the Trobriand Islands. And I would really like to thank you so much for a really excellent lecture. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.